Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, now offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts, with benefits that fit a variety of lifestyles and financial needs. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
I'm just so curious. I mean, do you hear sounds just walking down the street and in your mind identify what the tones are?
I'd say I don't usually do that, but I could if I had to. If it's, you know, I mean, sometimes like a bus engine or an airplane engine is maybe a little low to identify, but that's not something that I really hear most of the time.
You don't compulsively do a Beautiful Mind thing where you just can't help it?
No.
Got it. Well, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect on KNKX. I'm here with Andy Leung, who's in the second violin section at the Seattle Symphony. So how would you define perfect pitch for somebody who's never heard of it?
So I think perfect pitch is this concept that if you have perfect pitch, you can kind of pick out exact pitches of, or an exact note of, different sounds that you hear primarily, you know, played on instruments. So if you were to sit at a piano and play a note, I could tell you the name of that note.
Oh, well, that's funny you should say that, because producer Kevin Canisa happens to be sitting at the piano here. Could you sort of like not look? Here, do this.
Okay.
Put your hand there. Okay, Kevin's going to play a note, and could you just let us know what it is?
It is an A.
That is correct.
That is an E. That is a G sharp or an A flat.
So that's, how long have you been able to do that?
Almost for as long as I can remember. I started playing violin at the age of 5, and I think it was always something that I remember having.
Did you realize that it was something special when you were a kid?
I don't think I thought too much about it. It wasn't, you know, something that someone was like, oh, you have perfect pitch, that's amazing. It was just something that I guess I just had and lived with.
So a piano note is one thing. Mm-hmm. There's a finite number of notes on the piano keyboard, mm-hmm. and they're set to standard pitches. Mm-hmm. But how far does it go? If someone's just humming, could you?
Mm-hmm.
Could I just hum a random note?
Sure.
Okay.
I think it's about an F.
About an F?
Yeah. We'll say exactly an F. Sorry to sound so rude.
That's so fascinating. And so do you, in what ways does it help you as a musician and as a violinist?
I think there's a number of different ways that it helps you. But I think in terms of playing violin, sometimes, you know, we have to play very high and have these big shifts and kind of leaps up to such a small instrument. And being able to kind of hear before I get there where the note is in my head, I think really helps me identify and play, you know, fast passages and stuff like that.
How common is this in your world? Like in the Seattle Symphony violinists, about how many would you say have perfect pitch?
I haven't polled people, but I would say maybe 20% of people have it.
So it's still, even in the symphony, it's still a minority.
Yeah.
Have there ever been any times in your life outside of, you know, sitting in the orchestra chair where it has been of use to have perfect pitch?
I think it's kind of just like a cool party trick. Most of the times people are like, oh, you have perfect pitch. And then they'll find, you know, whatever object or whatever instrument they have. And they're like, tell me what note this is. And it's like, it really.
And obviously, you don't mind showing that off for people?
No.
You don't feel like they're making you dance?
The reactions are always fun to get out of people. So,
just a couple more things. I wonder if we could hit you up for a guess on the tone for. This first one is, it's a beep that we use pretty regularly to beep out bad words.
Okay. About a B, maybe a little higher than a B, but yeah.
Oh, right on the money. This is a song, a recorded song, and I wonder if you could tell us what key it's in.
Okay. I think that's an E major. Yeah. Hopefully.
If not, you'll be hearing from Eddie Vedder. Well, thank you so much, Andy. We really appreciate you telling us a little bit more about what it's like to have perfect pitch and about playing in the symphony.
You're very welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
Today on Sound Effect, our theme is perfection. Stories of chasing the pure, the flawless, the ideal. And by the way, Yellow Ledbetter by Pearl Jam is, in fact, in the key of E major, just like Andy said. A drive toward perfection can be a healthy thing. It can lead to progress and even to excellence. I'm glad that Da Vinci or Tolstoy or Billie Holiday weren't just shooting for adequate. But it can also be counterproductive, even destructive. For Caroline Gary, a marketing professional in Seattle, the pursuit of perfection crossed the line into illness. It was something she lived with and thrived in spite of. But then relationships and eventually parenthood brought it to a head. Caroline explains how it all began.
The first time I knew something was different was when I was in about seventh grade. What happened was I got a new pair of shoes for school. They were Nikes, and they were forest green and maroon with, like, detailing. They were, like, white leather, but they had all these cool details, and it was the style at the time, and I was really proud of them because I got a pair, and I found myself scrubbing them down every single day when I got home from school, every day, not just when they got really scuffed up, just really, I just felt this compulsion. I needed to, and if I didn't, I would think about it, and that's all I could think about was that my shoes are dirty. And so I would go into my room, into the closet, and hide and scrub them with baby wipes. And my mom found me one day, and she would continue to find me over time, even though she asked me, please, could you stop doing that? You know, that's kind of gross. When I really knew something was wrong was when I got my first car. I got a used 1999 silver Ford Taurus, and the moment I drove the car off the lot, I felt the weight of the world on my shoulders. What happened was I became very aware that anything that I would do if I moved wrong, if I opened the door wrong, because it was not keyless entry at that point, right? You had to put this very sharp key into the lock to open your car. And that was the first time that I really understood that I have a very difficult time with things becoming scratched. And the responsibility that I felt the day that I drove the car off the lot was, I've got to keep this pristine. I've got to keep this perfect. Now this is, it's mine now. It's my job to take care of this item. There's a really scary story about my mom and I. We packed up my car because I was heading out to Lubbock, Texas, which is the very west part of Texas, to go to college. And we were driving together, and I hardly let anybody ride in my car. My boyfriend at the time, and not even really family members, because I didn't trust them to not scratch it. I didn't trust them to put on their seatbelt in such a way that wouldn't scratch the paneling on the inside of the car. Things that you don't think about if you are just living. And we were on the highway, and my mom reached over innocently to change the volume or the channel of the radio. And I found myself sort of steering to the right because I was looking her direction just to make sure that she was doing it right. And I lost control of the car. And so we did a complete 360, and I overcorrected, and we found ourselves off the road, and we didn't flip, and there was a very small scratch on my car. And I felt really shameful as I worried about the small scratch that was on the car. The material things in my life, it was really as if I valued them much more than myself, or even those around me. And I didn't like it, and I feel shameful about it, but I didn't know how to stop that. When I was in college, I did find myself in a very abusive relationship where what I learned was, once I was in the relationship, you know, it started out fine and then it becomes not fine. But at that point, I was too afraid to face a lot of things in my own life, and I knew that I could stay and live at my boyfriend's apartment, therefore avoiding my triggers. I had gotten myself a new iMac. It was the time when they came out, the ones that were kind of sculptural. They sort of, you know, they were beautiful. It was this like white and silver, very sculptural looking thing. And I felt that if I touched it, I would scratch it the moment I got it out of the box. I started to believe that if I walked into my room and looked at it, that it would get scratched. If I breathed too heavily, it would get scratched. If I spoke, and certainly if anybody raised their voice, being in this relationship I was in at the time, that it would get scratched. I knew it. Nobody could tell me otherwise, even though the very rational part of my mind knew that not to be true. And so I chose to stay in that relationship for a very long time to avoid this trigger, which was my entire home, my apartment. And that did not change until he threatened me with a knife. And I really, for the first time in my life, chose myself first. That was a big turning point. That was a pivot point for me. I had another boyfriend. He and I had a conversation, which was essentially an ultimatum. Honestly, he told me, "I love you, but I can't love you like this. It's too hard." And so, what happened was, I went to a psychiatrist, and I received medication, and that was the door to recovery. I think one of the most relieving things when I first began treatment was that somebody knew more than me about what I had. So walking into this office and being asked questions about my life and my struggles and my mind and patterns, it was the first time that I felt understood. And I thought, I'm going to be okay. There are people who know what to do because I sure don't know what to do. And I can get help for this. What really works for me is exposure response prevention therapy. And I found that after I got married and my husband, Ben, he's a great cook. He is such a good cook, and cooking is messy. One evening, Ben had cooked this amazing, it was this chicken, and it was so messy and he didn't clean up just right. And I lost it. Ben is the kind of person that wouldn't just say, "You need to get help." He would say, "I've found a place that I think can help you. And here's their phone number, and will you go for me?" So after he cooked this amazing chicken dinner and didn't clean up just right, and I had a freak out, I went to really intensive outpatient therapy. And so this therapy is designed to ultimately prevent yourself from acting out these rituals. So in my case, if I would get a scratch on my car, is a great example, or somebody would ding my car, I would immediately want to Google about it. I would want to see if I should order something to fix it, you know, and I would have to do all of these things right now. And so therapy teaches you just to wait. You will come down from that peak, but you have to trust that you can. And so it's really saved my life. I don't think I could be a mom in the way that I am now if I hadn't gone through this therapy, because I have a two and a half year old. His name is Marshall, and he is really the joy of my life. And, you know, that said, he's a 2 year old, so he's running around with trucks and, you know, having them race across our coffee table and, eating sticky things and spilling milk, and I'm teaching him not to cry over spilled milk, so I can't freak out about it. You know, I've got to live this for him, and I want him to feel like it's okay. And it's really been hard to live with this, but it has also informed who I am. So to be there for my son and to let him mess things up is really great. For me, it's beautiful, and it's perfect. I'm so grateful to be here because I didn't think that I would make it. OCD, it's taught me to reframe what it means to be perfect, and that a lot of the things that are broken in me are what make me not perfect, but a really great person. And so I don't really aim for perfect anymore. You know, I aim for happy or good enough or safe. Alive is good. Being alive is perfect. Marshall!
Hi!
Ooh, what'd you do today?
I go to the beach.
You went to the beach?
Yeah.
What you eating there?
I'm eating popcorn.
You're eating popcorn?
Yeah.
Caroline Gary lives with her husband and her son Marshall in Seattle. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is perfection. Few people can talk about perfection with more authority than Elise Ray Statz, Olympian, head gymnastics coach at the University of Washington, and member of the USA Gymnastics Hall of Fame.
So standing at the chalk bowl, putting chalk on grips, putting water on grips, talking super positively to yourself, saying things like, I can, I will hit this bar routine. Then when you mount the apparatus, you just kind of fall into a groove. At least I did. Once I was in the groove of the routine, it felt very effortless. It just felt very fluid, very easy, and every skill just felt so precise. And it happened all the way up until the stuck landing on the dismount. The entire routine felt that way, and I had never experienced that in my whole career until that moment. I remember holding the stick, so I didn't move my feet, I didn't move my arms, I just held it for an extra couple of seconds to soak it in because it felt so good. And then when the score comes up as a perfect 10, it's the best feeling. It's the best feeling. It's, you know, it's a million hours of hard work and you see it come up and it's just this moment of perfection. I just did a perfect routine in the eyes of the judges, and it's so rare. So it's amazing.
And how many of those have you gotten?
Two. In gymnastics, the idea of perfection starts early. And so as soon as you kind of transition into competitive gymnastics, this idea of perfectionism is introduced. You start to learn that each skill has a very certain way that it needs to be done. So, I mean, I can remember striving for that early on because I thought it was very fun and exhilarating. The struggle of perfectionism comes as early as the introduction to it, because you're striving for it every day when you practice, and you're certainly not reaching it every day in practice. So you learn quickly that it's the process of it that you learn to enjoy and not necessarily the result of the perfection. You know, gymnasts have this sweet window, peak at 18 or 19. So my window for the Olympics was just one, and it was 2000. In 2000, there were just two meets to qualify to the Olympics. One was the national championship, and the second was the Olympic trials.
Of all these faces, only six are going to the Olympic Games.
The national championship meet was the best meet of my entire career. If I look back, it was one of those meets that just flowed. It felt easy. Everything was just happening exactly the way I wanted it to happen.
Elise Ray!
I ended up winning that competition, which was massive for my confidence going into hopefully the Olympics. Olympic trials, I felt the pressure more because maybe the title, the trials, you know exactly what it is. And the pressure got to me a little bit. It wasn't as perfect as my national championship meet. I squeaked it out. You know, it was still good enough to place first, but it didn't feel like it did at national championship.
Look at Bella Caroli. Look at the crowd. Look at Kelly Hill. And look at Elise Ray. That seals it.
So 96 was the first women's gymnastics team to ever win a gold medal for team. And it was just a massive accomplishment for gymnastics, for the United States. It was amazing. So we, being the next generation Olympic team, were expected to do just that. I think we were expected in 2000 to win gold, and that anything less wasn't good enough. So in warm-up, the all-around finals, I could not land a vault to my feet. And I was landing almost in a scary way, on my back, on my butt. I mean, it was very unusual. I thought it was nerves. I don't know. And I remember kind of shrugging my shoulders and walking back to where I would start my run, thinking, I have no idea what's happening, but I need to run harder because I haven't made one, and I just need to get to my feet. So and that's like the worst correction that anybody could ever give you on vault. Just run harder. That's not a legitimate correction. And so in the competition, that's literally what I did.
Warm up time. Elise Ray is on the vault for the United States, the third member of their representation here in the all around.
She said this morning she wasn't concerned about her shoulder at all. Oh my gosh.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. That is.
You know, I didn't make them in the competition either. And it was the most deflating feeling. It was like an immediate heartbreak when I fell on your first event. You know, you have yourself in this mental place of, I can medal. I can medal in this all-around final. And then very first event, you fall, and you know that all your medal contention is gone. Snap of a finger. It was really, really hard to finish that competition. So vault, bars, beam, floor is the Olympic order. So right before my third event, which was beam, I heard a really unusual kind of rumbling in the arena.
First place. Now we have a delay in the warm-up of vault going to the third rotation.
And it was enough to pull me out of my mental game. You know, I'm really, really focused in competition. But it was enough for me to kind of look up out of my bubble and ask my coach what's happening.
Well, this is amazing. And they...
motioning to raise it.
That... unbelievable. If that is the case,
and she told me they realized that the vault was set 5 centimeters too low. Every competitor that competed on the setting too low will get to repeat the event at the end of the competition, so essentially a fifth event, which is unheard of. It's unheard of to have any equipment malfunction at the Olympic Games. This is the pinnacle meet. This is it. And I remember warming up and thinking, oh, there's the repulsion off the table. You know, it was set to the proper height. And, oh, this is how it normally feels. And I made it. It was great. But it was too late. Yeah, too late. So I think I ended up 13th or 14th in the all-around. So that's, you know, counting a fall, and nobody ever medals with a fall. Yeah, and so, you know, you wonder what if. You wonder if I had nailed the vault that I nailed in the quote-unquote fifth rotation, how would that have changed the trajectory of the competition? And, you know, I don't know the answer to that question, but that was a very difficult what if to endure for the next couple years after 2000. Then I headed home from Sydney, got home kind of October of the year, and just went home and actually had the first break / vacation I've had, it had been years and years and years. I had signed to go to the University of Michigan, and I was going to start there in January. So I had a couple of months. After the Olympics, there was a part of me that thought I wanted to be done, that I wanted to just be done completely, not just in the elite scene, but I didn't know if I had the strength or the love for the sport to do it for 4 more years. And so I was really apprehensive the first bit at Michigan. I really was. I think it helped that I arrived in January, so I arrived in competition season. And There is no comparison between an elite competition and a collegiate competition. Collegiate competitions are so much fun. It's team-oriented. It's high energy. It's unlike anything that I had experienced. And so I think it was a blessing that I started in right away, because I found the love for it again pretty quickly after I thought that I wanted to be done entirely. So I was thinking, what's next? And so I sort of fell into coaching at a local gym in Maryland. And I was very surprised by how much I loved it. I honestly never thought I'd be a coach. I think perfectionism can be nourishing or a place of happiness for someone who embraces the journey of it. So it has to be the journey first. If you're constantly waiting for the outcome of perfection and holding on tight to that outcome, you'll drive yourself crazy because it takes forever and it may not happen. But if you embrace the journey of it and you find the challenge of it exciting, and you reach little bits of it or you get a little taste of it and it's motivating, it can be so exciting and so fun. Even if you don't reach the final outcome and you've enjoyed your journey, then you've really gotten a taste of what perfectionism can feel like positively.
That's Elise Ray Statz, head coach of the University of Washington gymnastics team. And a little postscript, the 2000 U.S. Olympic team finished in fourth place, heartbreakingly just out of the medals. But then...
10 years later, almost to the day, I get an email. And the email says, congratulations, your team has been awarded the bronze medal from the 2000 Olympics because the Chinese team has been caught cheating, essentially. I looked at that email. I think I read it 10 times. Called my coach and said, did you get this? What is happening? I didn't believe it. I didn't know if it was spam. I didn't know what was happening. She said, believe it or not, yes. And she kind of explained that the Chinese team had cheated. And essentially, they had competed underage gymnasts, so they were younger than 16. So they were stripping them of their medals and awarding us. The feeling of it was so bittersweet. It was, you know, when I was awarded the medal, it's hanging around my neck, and then I take it home and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, this is an Olympic medal. I mean, that's incredible. But then immediately following was the feeling of, do I really deserve it? I would be lying if I said that, you know, every time I held it, I didn't think it was the most amazing thing ever. But I don't know if it feels like mine.
We're sitting in your dining area in your living room, and I don't see it like in a shrine on the wall or anything. What did you do with it?
It's up on the top shelf over there on the on that bookshelf. I put it in a shadow box. I put it on the wall, and then I thought, nope, I can't look at it every day. And so when it's on the bookshelf, it's in its little case that it came in. It's there if I'd like to look at it, and if I don't, I don't have to.
This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're focusing on the nearly unattainable perfection. Seattle photographer Tim Durkin is known for documenting the lives of men and women who are homeless. But Tim also spends quite a bit of time chasing down the moon. A photo he's taken many times, you may have seen one of them, is of a full moon sitting atop the Space Needle, sometimes like a basketball balanced on one finger, sometimes like a big scoop of ice cream held aloft in a dish. Durkin says those images have universal appeal.
A moon rising up above the Space Needle isn't signifying political allegiance, you know? It's just something everybody can admire. And I think that has a lot of value in today's world.
Tim Durkin's images capture the beautiful symmetry of the precise moment when the moon and this iconic Seattle landmark line up. Sound Effect producer Jennifer Wing spent some time with Tim to learn how he composes those perfect pictures.
The last time Tim and I went on a walk, it was up and down Broadway Avenue in Seattle's Capitol Hill neighborhood. It was a winter's night when the temperature dipped below freezing. His camera lens was focused on the men and women huddled in doorways and bus stops who didn't have a warm place to go.
We talked to a young man who was recovering in recovery down here at Pine and Pike. We're still friends on Facebook.
On this day, you would think it was summer, if not for the sun hanging pretty low in the sky at 3:30 in the afternoon. We are in front of Espresso Vivace on Broadway. This little shop is one of Tim's reliable sources of caffeine. With a bearded grin, he opens his arms in a sweeping gesture, welcoming me to his outdoor office.
This is where the ideas come to me the best, right here on my home street, the 300 block of Broadway East.
He lays out the plan, and it's pretty ambitious.
We're going to go take a couple pictures that I love. We're going to try and get a picture of the rising moon, which is kind of a signature shot of mine. We're going to try and put it against the backdrop of the Space Needle, which is always challenging. The moon is a very finicky creature, Luna. And then if we are lucky, the weather will hold and we'll come back across this side of the city and we'll get a shot of the sun setting against the Space Needle. So it's a two-for-one night. And I love that. There's nothing I'd rather be doing right now. It's, 70 degrees. Got my coffee.
This is Tim's 9th or 10th shot of espresso of the day. Tim would be the first to tell you that there is no such thing as a perfect picture. For him, perfection is everything that happens before he presses his index finger on the camera's shutter.
Perfection, to me, is more of a state of mind than a state of being, if that makes sense. Where I can just kind of close the walls, close the doors, and focus on the photo,
How do you get there? How do you get to that place?
You fail. You fail over and over and over again, even when you practice, even when you try your hardest. What if it clouds up? It might get cloudy tonight. It's been sunny for 4 or 5 days in a row. What if it gets cloudy? There you go. That no moon picture against the Space Needle. So it pays to practice, it pays to fail, but we should probably get moving.
Yeah, let's go. Okay.
We hop in the car and head across town to a parking lot at the top of the Magnolia Bridge. Years ago, this is where Tim took his first picture of a supermoon. He worked out where the moon would rise by charting out its path on a paper map with a compass.
And I looked at my map and I got my pencil out and wrote circle, and I'm like, this is it. I practice, this is my shot.
But then another guy walked by wearing a hoodie. He had a camera too.
He kind of like nods at me and I'm like, where are you going? And he just keeps on walking down the bridge. Well, half hour later, the moon comes up and it's over here by like the Smith Tower. It's not even close to the Space Needle. That's about 8 degrees difference. I was off by this much, tiny 8 degrees. He got the shot. It got a National Geographic. I got nothing. I got 3 likes on Facebook, and I'll just never forget it. I'm like, how did he know? And well, he was better at math, better at geometry. He used using the same kind of compass and approach that I was, but he had done it and failed more. So, and that's when I saw that, I'd been making a mistake. The difference between magnetic north and true north is a big difference, is a huge difference. Who would have thought?
True North is in the middle of the Arctic Ocean. Magnetic North is near a small island in northern Canada. And Magnetic North is on the move. Some scientists predict that in a few decades, it'll be in Siberia. Anyway, today, there's an app on Tim's phone for that. We walk down the narrow sidewalk on the Magnolia Bridge, looking for the sweet spot.
So here we are. This rickety old bridge, you'll get the full flavor. It's always fun when people are honking, and wait till you feel that bus go by.
Queen Anne Hill is just ahead in the distance, and downtown Seattle, the skyline spreads out before us to the right. Tim's carrying a $10,000 lens, his camera, a tripod, batteries. Altogether, this stuff weighs about 40 pounds. Tim walks with a bit of a limp, and this limp is new. He was documenting life in a homeless encampment when he slipped and broke his ankle. After spending the last few months in a cast, Tim is really happy to be back on his own two feet.
Nothing like a little fresh air, cement trucks, diesel.
At this point, it's late afternoon and there are clouds.
Somewhere in that heavenly mess of clouds is a beautiful Luna.
We need a big broom.
It's close.
To sweep the clouds away.
What are you going to do?
I'll look at some photos you took when everything was
cooperating. I'll send you my old photo. I'll send you the photo that I took from this place.
When I first moved here, I was living in Bellingham, and I had an apartment that overlooked Bellingham Bay on High Street up by the university.
Yeah.
And it was such a great place. And it was the first time I ever saw the moon rise and set in front of me.
There's something really calming about it, you know? It gets your imagination fired up. It has for, you know, however long we've been walking around the earth, you know? And it does the same to me. I finally got a shot of a Space Needle moon into a National Geographic publication.
Congratulations!
So I'm waiting for the check, $400, and in the book. They're sending me a book as well.
We lug all of the equipment up the hill, hop in the car, and drive to a spot on Capitol Hill overlooking I-5. The clouds that were an obstacle just a few minutes ago are now gorgeous orange, red, and salmon pink streaks, thanks to the setting sun, which is now at the very base of the Space Needle.
Yeah, getting a couple fun shots. And that's it. That's the shot we're going to get, and it'll be interesting.
It looks like the Space Needle's rising up out of Middle Earth, which has just been born.
It's kind of, that is beautiful. I'm going to use that one.
For the last few hours, Tim's attention has been pretty focused on the sky, and now it shifts back to people.
What's going on, my brother?
A man on a bike stops to talk. He happens to be one of Tim's neighbors.
I just emailed you.
That's what all the girls say, man.
Yes.
He wants to know if Tim can take pictures at a memorial service for a woman they both knew. Tim says, of course, he'll be there.
That story came from Sound Effects Jennifer Wing. To see the photo of the Space Needle and the setting sun that Tim Durkin took that night, go to our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. We're telling stories of perfection today on Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. For an artist trying to realize her vision, it's crucial to have the right materials. Behind every rich color of paint or dye or glass is a formula, a recipe that someone has developed and tweaked. Art materials that are pure and nearly perfect are in high demand. Sound Effect's Bethany Denton brings us the story of one woman's obsession with concocting the perfect ingredients for a masterpiece.
The Pacific Northwest is known for a lot of things, including, you may or may not know, glass. Yes, there's the Chihuly of it all, but the local glass scene is much bigger than just him. Seattle alone is home to dozens of glass studios where artists make anything from the confoundingly ubiquitous glassy baby candle holders to light fixtures that look like cephalopods. And it doesn't hurt that our burgeoning marijuana industry gives many young artists the chance to make pipes and bongs that are both practical and fetching. At the heart of this industry is a symbiotic relationship between the artists, the stereotypically tough and tattooed glassblowers, and the formulators, the chemists that devise the exact combination of materials needed to make glass colors like scarlet pink, guacamole green, forget-me-not blue. After all, a painter would be nothing without the paint maker.
I'm born in Bulgaria. I raised in Bulgaria. I work more than 40 years in Bulgaria. And I'm proud that I learned all this stuff in my country.
Mom Kapiva is right to be proud. She's a small woman with apricot hair whose hands are both soft and weathered. She's proud of her grandchildren, and she's proud of her two sons, Gayo, who she tells me is a chemical engineer like her, and Igor, who she tells me worked at Microsoft for a time. She's proud of her business, Momka's Glass, which Gayo and Igor help run. She's proud to be Bulgarian, she's proud of the 6 decades of experience she has making glass, and she's proud of her reputation as one of the best glass formulators around. She tells me all this in her brightly lit kitchen in Arlington, Washington, where she holds in her hands her life's work. That's that tinkling sound you're hearing, by the way. Now, hold that thought, we'll come back to that later. Long before Mom Kapiva made a name for herself in the Pacific Northwest glass scene, she was a young woman growing up in what was then the People's Republic of Bulgaria. Bulgaria, which Momka tells me is smaller than Washington State, was historically an agrarian society. But under the Bulgarian Communist Party's planned economy, the country industrialized. Back then, everyone, women as well as men, were encouraged to become engineers, proud cogs in a powerful machine. And so that's what Momka did. She specialized in glass technology and excelled at a glass factory that produced everything from fine crystal glassware to fluorescent tubing and lab beakers. Later, Momka became a teacher at a vocational high school that specialized in glass, and she wrote a book. In fact, she wrote the book on glass. It's called Technology of Glass, and it's still used in Bulgaria today. Momka worked for her factory and for her country for more than 40 years before she retired. All was well. And then the Soviet Union dissolved, leading to vast political and economic change in Bulgaria and other countries in the Eastern Bloc.
Igor this time moved to the United States. He married and has a daughter. And I decided to move here to be a grandma. And when I came here, I discovered that Seattle is a big glass area. And I, of course, wanted to continue work with glass.
This was in 1994. Momka was 57 and had already retired once, but she couldn't give up the opportunity to do the work she loved most. So despite knowing very little English, she sent her impressive resume around to lots of local glass shops, and eventually she was hired at a brand new Portland company called Glass Alchemy.
They wanted to have special glass, that is borosilicate glass.
A quick technical note here. You might be picturing the glass blowers that I mentioned earlier, using tongs to pull and manipulate molten glass like taffy. Well, that's what's called soft glass, or soda-lime glass. Its chemical composition makes it much more fluid and easy to work with, but fragile to changes in temperature once it's hardened. Borosilicate, on the other hand, is what you'd call hard glass. It's a lot more durable and resistant to high temperature. Chances are you have borosilicate cookware in your kitchen. Its resistance to high temperature makes it hard to work with and expensive to make, but durable for a lot of products like marbles or beads or other recreational tools not available in Bulgaria.
It's most popular now for pipes for marijuana. Before, I never supported people who make a pipe, but marijuana is very popular and legal now.
Momka was asked to create rich, opaque colors in a type of glass that was normally reserved for more somber tasks. So she went to work converting a familiar soft glass formula for the color orange.
I tested 1, 2, 3 times this formula, and I took out my test. It's become nice, beautiful orange color.
The shop called it crayon orange because, well, it looked just like a shiny orange crayon. Next, Momka created crayon red and crayon yellow, both as rich and opaque as the orange. She formulated a total of 37 colors in 6 months, but her crayon colors put her name on the map.
And I received so many emails. Thank you, Momka. And after a while, I decided to come back to Seattle to make our own company. I will show her sample set of 5 inches, which I have.
All right, back to Arlington, back to Momka's brightly lit kitchen. She's there with her son Igor, who puts around behind us making coffee. She hands me her life's work, 2 bundles of glass rods wrapped in rubber bands, some the size of golf pencils, some the size of regular-sized pencils. Their colors remind me of citrus fruits, icy blues, and root beer browns. She takes a moment to show me rods that are multicolored, like her 8-colored masterpiece.
Oh, it's here. Yes. That's a Gypsy Queen. All these beads, marble.
Does it make you feel proud to look at these rods?
Oh, yes, yes. I like them.
Her son Igor is tall and broad with black hair and a quick smile.
Do you want milk on it?
Mm-hmm. He runs the business side of things here in Arlington, while his brother Gayo oversees production at Momka's very own glass factory in Bulgaria.
Yeah, I mean, business is basically a very small operation. The decision was to really keep it small. All the glass is pulled by hand, for example. So we're more like people who make very small batch wine or special types of cheese or something like that.
But same time,
Momka tells me that she still loves to teach, especially young people, how to make glass, but that she has to be careful not to give too many of her secrets away. She tells me that she constantly gets emails from other formulators asking her the proportions of this chemical to make that color and so on. She won't even patent her formulas because to do so would make them public and, ironically, easy to steal.
It's a trade secret.
Are you protective of your formulas?
Of course. My formulas are my secret. Mostly they are in my head. And I'm not going to sell them. I do not like to give to somebody my formulas.
It's competitive.
Yes. It's competitive. Yes, true.
When I start to ask more specific questions about Momka's formulas, Igor politely asks that we change the subject. And I suddenly become aware that I might be coming off as a slugworth to their Willy Wonka.
It's really difficult to keep turning people away as they want to know more and more, because that's the only advantage, right? Like in the modern market and in the modern world, there's always the potential for someone else with a lot more money to come in and to do exactly what you're doing and sell it way cheaper. And of course, it's challenging just to keep everything small so that we keep it at a certain level of quality.
Yes, formula, it's our future, because we create very nice, high-quality glass with these formulas. And my goal is never to stop until I'm able to work and think properly. Our quality, us, and still the best in the market.
For someone who came of age in the Soviet Union's planned economy, Momka has a strong grasp of the market and her place in it. To this day, she follows trends and formulates new colors of glass, keeping her competitive edge. She's a survivor, and she's not going anywhere.
And that is the good for us, because business is running smooth now. Only test and experience, nothing else.
That story from Sound Effects' Bethany Denton. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing with Bethany Denton. And this week we welcome back the momtastic Posey Gruner. Very exciting. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. And special thanks this week to Kari Erickson, Shiva Shafi, Janae Janik, and Paul Currington of Fresh Ground Stories. And we dedicate this episode to the memory of Sandy Dye, a stalwart at KNKX who kept us on track through the good times and the bad. Our very best wishes to Sandy's family. You can find our podcast on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever else you get your audio, including your smart speaker. Just say, "Play Sound Effect, the podcast." Join us again next week when our theme is One of Many. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.